Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Andrea Seabrook.
And Ken Rudin is away.
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 Isn't that nice?
Far, far away. And Andrea, our special guest, Andrea Seabrook, will be talking just a little bit about all those wonderful achievements and accomplishments by America's most popular institution, the United States Congress. But first, let's talk a little bit about the contest for the Republican nomination for president of the United States. Herman Cain?
Who's the flavor of the day?
Well, Herman Cain has been the flavor in recent weeks, but of course, we are now on the, I believe, fifth story about either sexual harassment or extramarital affairs. The particular one we've been working on this past week is a little bit different, a woman alleging a 13-year affair, which he
on and off 13 years,
on and
barely,
off,
but
on
with
and
gifts
off.
And money, and that's what I heard.
That's right, and tickets to some prize fights and so forth, and he says he was giving her financial assistance, and that's why there are phone calls between them at 4 o'clock in the morning and so on, and he tells us that he's soon going to speak to his wife about it and get this all resolved.
This is one more time that he totally messed up the PR campaign about this. I mean, what I hear people talking about in Washington is that his whole campaign is a case study in how not to run a political campaign.
All right, but we also have to say that in all likelihood, Herman Cain did not set out back in March, February, January of this year thinking, here's my path to the White House. He, in all likelihood, looked upon this as a kind of business opportunity. Mm-hmm. Everything that he laid out through the fall, with the exception of going to the candidate debates, was about a book tour. And he was going to the states where he could get a book signing party as opposed to going to places like Iowa and New Hampshire mm-hmm. or setting up a real campaign there.
And then suddenly, oops.
Well, suddenly, oops.
Everyone else imploded.
Right. Rick Perry said oops, and everybody else should have said oops. And there were a great number of candidates lying about on the pathway, and Herman Cain was suddenly the man of the hour. And that could also be true of another candidate
for
president. Well,
this is like the best thing that's happened to Washington in a long time. At least people have been around Washington long enough to know the man pretty well.
And we're, of course, talking about
Mr. Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House. When this presidential primary was really heating up, Gingrich was off on a cruise of the Mediterranean with his third wife, and had a complete mutiny by his top campaign staff.
The entire New Hampshire staff.
Yeah, because he wasn't campaigning when the primary was heating up. So it's arguably, or it sure looks like, another case of suddenly the front runner.
And with the fall of Herman Cain, following the fall of Rick Perry, following the fall of Michelle Bachmann, following the fall of all the people who decided not to run because they didn't think the field needed any new candidates, all of a sudden Newt seems to be the last fellow standing, and he's not standing. He's at a dead run, and he is suddenly not only ahead in the national polls, he is phenomenally ahead in some crucial states, including perhaps the most crucial, Florida.
He's even ahead in polls showing a matchup between Barack Obama and Newt Gingrich.
Of course he is. He is the new Republican answer.
So let's remember what makes him different, and that is that Newt can talk around the corner and down the street and back again. The man knows how to talk. And he's got that thing that Bill Clinton had, that Barack Obama has, that Ronald Reagan. He can really energize people with his speeches. His big problem, of course, is that rather than talking like a renegade outside Washington guy, he's been in Washington for decades and made tons and tons and tons of money not lobbying, in air quotes, for big businesses.
And other people that he himself has vilified
exactly.
as being the source of the mortgage meltdown.
We know that what he was doing was getting businesses that hired him access to lawmakers and important committees. And if that's not lobbying, then I don't know what lobbying is. But his answer when asked about this was, oh, well, I wasn't lobbying. I didn't need to lobby because I was making $60,000 a speech roughly, at the time, which is more than the median income of the average voter in South Carolina. So that doesn't make him look good either. It's just there's serious questions about whether he's going to implode again.
Well, the issue that I thought was most damning, and which has probably gotten the least attention, was the work that one of his think tanks did on behalf of the healthcare industry, essentially. And through the last decade, even before Obamacare was actually being written, he was advocating for something called the individual mandate, which is the heart now of the new healthcare law, which is being challenged by conservatives in the Supreme Court on the basis of the unconstitutionality of the individual mandate.
Yeah.
Now, that's been a killer for Mitt Romney. Meanwhile, a think tank associated with, created by, and essentially a front for Newt Gingrich is getting paid $37 million over a course of years to advocate for a series of healthcare policies built around that same individual mandate. Can he get away with that as we get back into the debates and the other candidates call him on it?
Well, it's backwards day, though. I mean, in a way, he might be able to get away with it because if he's all he's doing is running against Mitt Romney, well, neither of them are going to touch it.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
How can one accuse the other of
Ron Paul. Ron Paul has made a hard-hitting ad that's running on the internet, and that will have a shorter version, I'm sure, on television in Iowa and New Hampshire, in which he really lays out the case against Newt Gingrich as a Washington insider, handsomely paid, to advocate for policies that he now says he's not for. And that's not even to count the cap and trade or the association with the concept that he has, because he sat down on that love seat with Nancy Pelosi and talked about the need to do something about climate change.
This is why I think Washington reporters and people who've been here a long time is so excited about the idea of this, because there's so much history here. And the question is, can Newt escape his own past?
So if it's not going to be Mitt Romney, and I'm not saying that it's not, because all year long we've been saying inevitably the Republicans will have to buckle down and say, okay, we don't like him, but he's the one who can beat Barack Obama, so we'll settle for him. And I still think that's the likeliest outcome. But if he is fading at this hour of testing, and if we believe Newt Gingrich will eventually blow up one way or another, and if Rick Perry already has, Herman Cain already has, Michelle Bachmann already has, are we looking down the list to again talk about Michelle Bachmann, or are we going to talk about Rick Santorum, or do we come back to somebody who is a great champion and hero to about 10% of the Republican base, Ron Paul?
Ron Paul. I think it's really fascinating at this point. And I think the only reason why Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, Ron Paul, these people are still in the race is because they're hoping for that. They must be hoping for their second chance right before the primaries actually happen. Because I think everyone's bet is that the guy who's the flavor of the month or the week, the day before, you know, New Hampshire, is the guy who's going to get, you know, or gal, in Michelle Bachmann's case, is going to get that momentum and go on. It's like Survivor at this point.
It is a television reality show in many respects. And I think most of the longer visioned Republicans, the people who have been around for a long time and want to think about what the party's situation is going to be a year from now, 3 years from now, 7 years from now, and so forth, those people are starting to wonder, what are we going to do?
It's amazing. It reminds me so often of 2004. I was going back and forth between the Kerry and the Bush campaigns, and the fact that Kerry became the nominee at all was just because he happened to be the guy everyone thought could beat Bush. And in fact, he couldn't beat Bush and didn't beat Bush, but he only got to be that nominee as sort of by default.
Well, and the others canceled each other out. They fought each other. Dick Gephardt thought that his big opponent was Howard Dean. Dean thought it was Gephardt. The two of them went after each other, hammer and tong, destroyed each other largely in the weeks going up to Iowa and New Hampshire, and John Kerry was the beneficiary.
There's one thing we haven't talked about, and that is in the idea that Mitt is fading. Here's what I've found myself wondering. The Mitt versus Mitt ad that the Obama campaign put out is brilliant.
From the creator of I'm Running for Office for Pete's Sake comes the story of two men trapped in one body, Mitt versus Mitt.
And they have a short version of it, which is Mitt, you know, talking about health care back when he was running for governor and senator, which he lost, the Senate campaign he lost, and then talking about health care now and abortion and all these other things where he has changed positions.
180 degrees. Many cases.
All
astonishingly.
Right.
Total reversal.
My question is, did the Obama campaign put out that ad because they wanted to weaken Mitt in the primaries, running up to the primaries? Are they hoping to run against a Newt Gingrich or a Michelle Bachmann? The conventional wisdom is sort of like they're already running against him because they assume he's the guy. But maybe they put that out because it is so damning in the primary more than anything.
That's right. Well, the two motivations are not mutually exclusive. I mean, if they could knock him out in the sense of knocking him out in the Republican primaries and get some other candidate they're less afraid of, they'd be more than glad to have that strategy work. And if, on the other hand, Mitt's going to wind up being the guy just because he's got the best chance of beating Obama, they would like to get started knocking him down now.
Yeah.
Here's another scenario.
Yes.
The Republicans don't come up with somebody that they're terribly confident will beat Obama, and all of a sudden, we get the emergence of some kind of independent or third-party candidate. This person would be so attractive that independents would desert the president, that only the hardcore Democrats would vote for Obama, and that Republicans and independents could rally around some other option, somebody who was more acceptable to Republicans than the current president, or perhaps even their own nominee.
Such as?
Well, one name. The name is always a problem, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I think John Huntsman, if he's willing to desert the party and go ahead and run as a third party, could possibly do that. I mean, he, more than anyone on both sides right now, seems to carry the banner of joining together as a country and moving forward to govern.
He's clearly a Republican with some claim to being a traditional conservative. Certainly, as governor of Utah, that was the kind of record that he had. But he is clearly not conservative enough, or at least not activist enough or aggressive enough to succeed in this field of Republican candidates. No one has gravitated to him at all, and his numbers have remained in the low single digits. But it would be a different story entirely if he were running not for the Republican nomination, but for some kind of third-party magic.
The longer I have covered politics, the more I understand that it is intensely emotional. It is just not a rational process, no matter how much journalists would like it to be. It really has to do with people's gut reactions, oftentimes, to the candidates. And that's why a Newt can suddenly surge. And that's why a Kane can suddenly fall apart. I mean,
speaking of the irrational, Andrea, let's turn to your specialty.
Why, thank you.
What about those people on Capitol Hill? Since the super committee's collapse, since the super committee more or less lived down to its expectations and completely failed to come up with a plan for reducing the federal deficit over the next 10 years, what has Congress been doing, and what do they have to do in order to get out of town before Christmas?
Well, let me tick off a few things that they have done.
Monday, nothing, and Tuesday, nothing, Wednesday, and Thursday, nothing.
I was watching to see whether or not you were even going to put your hand up to count fingers.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem, right? Is that you can't tick off. I mean, you can tick off a few things that they have done, but only when they've had the absolute, utter collapse of the economy as a consequence to not acting. I mean, I was bamboozled, I think, by the rules of the super committee personally, because they made it so possible for something to come out of that. They took away every usual stumbling block to something getting through.
That's right.
You didn't have to get a 60-vote majority in the Senate. You could bypass the actual leadership of the House. If they didn't like it, it would come to the floor anyway.
No excuses.
All those 12 people had to do was agree. Seven of them.
Not even a super majority.
Yeah,
just a simple majority.
Yeah, 6 + 1. I mean, one side plus one, or maybe the middle seven, or, you know, 3 and 4. Who knows? But they had to just come up with a plan that would cut $1.2 trillion, which isn't even anywhere near. It's a quarter the sort of grand bargain that the president and Speaker Boehner and the Gang of Six had been talking about in the summer. And it just fell apart. I mean, they didn't even come out and have a press conference blaming each other. They issued a press release that just said,
"We failed."
Or maybe the word of the year,
oops.
It's like, you know, I find it utterly astonishing that they could show such intent and still not be able to deliver the goods. And here we are at the end of the year, and Congress is ready to stagger home to their families. And
if they'll have them.
Yeah, if they'll have them. And they have a few things they have to do, lest they all be recalled in a fit of anger by the voters. And
yes.
That is extend the payroll tax cut, which is wildly popular among voters of both parties. And
everybody likes paying lower taxes, especially that particular tax.
Especially the tax that is a bigger part of the incomes of lower income people.
That's right.
And middle class.
It's what
people.
Everybody pays.
It's what, everybody.
It's what you pay even if you're making minimum wage.
Yes.
And so to knock the amount that each person pays down by about half is felt.
Right.
So everybody wants to extend it.
Everybody.
But
the question is
how to pay for
whether,
it.
I think, to
I
pay
think
for it.
Right.
I think
it isn't how anymore. It's just
yeah.
whether. They'll load it back on the deficit, which is what they did in the lame duck session 1 year ago.
For a few seconds, the question was how to pay for it. And it quickly became clear that they couldn't agree between the parties or even among the Republican Party on what things should be cut in order to pay for it. And
either in the sense of spending cuts or in the sense of, as Harry Reid in the Senate proposed, a special new surtax on people making $1 million a year.
And remember, that's not people who have $1 million. That's
no.
people who earn $1 million
each
year.
Year.
Yeah,
and,
each
and
every
year.
And
if they don't make $1 million in a particular year, they wouldn't be subject to this
exactly.
tax.
The thing that was interesting this week is inside the Republican conference meeting in the House, this is the closed-door meeting that the Republicans have every Wednesday usually, there had been this rabble-rousing group that was saying, wait a second, we can't even pass another tax cut unless we pay for it. This is the whole deal here is deficits, right? So we got to pay for this thing. Well, the Speaker and the Majority Leader, Boehner and Cantor, said, wait a second, you're Republicans. You can't be against a tax cut under any circumstances, paid for or not. And that is the moment where it pivots from how do we pay for it to
whether
we pay for it. And it's, you know, it's absolutely, I think the question is, no, we don't pay for it at this point. I think you can pretty much bet that that's going to be law by the end of the year.
This is, of course, taking us in exactly the wrong direction.
Right.
The supercommittee fails to cut $1.2 trillion, and we add the cost of this payroll tax cut extension
yes.
to the deficit, so we're still moving in the wrong direction.
Right. Although Cantor is circulating an idea called the trigger fix or something like that. That's what people are calling it, which would extend the payroll tax cut. It would extend, I think it fixes the DOC problem.
Oh, yes, and we do have to fix the Medicare doctor fix.
Yes, that's
yes.
another one that has to be done on the AMT. There's just like a list of things you always do in December because nobody actually wants to write these things in law because they cost so damn much over time. You just don't have to know about it beforehand.
Well, you know about it, but right before Christmas, people have one or two other things on their mind.
Yes.
And they would much prefer to not be paying attention to Congress. And even in the midst of all of this maelstrom, I don't think they will be paying attention to Congress over the next 3 weeks. They're going to be paying attention to their own holiday, pre-holiday planning and lives and so
right.
on.
Yeah.
And they will not be paying that much attention as Congress goes in the exact opposite direction from
right.
what they have promised to do.
The other thing in the Cantor proposal is a shift of some of the cuts that are supposed to automatically come in 2013, so-called sequestration, away from the military. And that is going to be the thing that keeps this from getting passed because even if it were to pass in the Senate, President Obama has said he will veto anything that takes away the lawmakers' own consequences, their own time out for having not done work in the supercommittee. So
he's going to hold their feet to the fire.
He is. He's vowed to. We'll see.
One thing that will not be extended on all this, at least not indefinitely, is the notable House career of Massachusetts Democratic Congressman Barney Frank. He has announced that as the 112th Congress ends, so will that career. He is not going to seek re-election in his newly redrawn Massachusetts district, which would be much tougher for him to win.
Mm-hmm.
He may well have won it anyway, but he's decided, enough. I'm not going to do all the things I would need to do to win one more.
And when he talked about it, you know, he expressed a lot of frustration at how things are going anymore, just talking about how there's no one compromising on anything. Nobody wants to work together for anything anymore. And on a personal note for me, I felt like I had finally gotten to Congress and, you know, was like a player on the Hill when I wanted to do a little interview with Barney Frank in Speaker's Lobby. And I walked up to him and I had had some piece on in that morning. And he said, "Seabrook, I'm always amazed by your ability to focus on the least consequential thing up here in Congress, you know." Like, you know, and I was thinking, wow, he knows my name and heard my story this morning. You know, he's like barking in my microphone. So,
until you've been abused by Barney Frank.
By Barney Frank. And, yeah. You know, it is, he's always been somewhat of a interesting, eccentric guy in the Capitol. But recently he has seemed sort of disheveled. He walks into the Speaker's Lobby and sort of throws himself down on a bench. Kind of just stares around waiting for reporters to come talk to him. He's
kind of gone back in some respects to the Barney of years ago, who was always disheveled, and then he decided he was going to clean up his act and eventually rose to be the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, previously thought of as banking. Mm-hmm. And he was largely responsible for the law that was passed to re-regulate the financial services industry after the great meltdown of 2007-2008, now known, of course, as
Dodd-Frank.
I think people will be addressing him as Dodd for much of the rest of his life. But Barney has decided that all of this history is enough, and he's going to go back to his private life and let Congress go on to its own reward. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Andrea Seabrook.
Join us again next week when Ken Rudin will be back for It's All Politics from NPR.
It'll be a lot funnier then.
It will?
Yeah.
I love you. You love me. We're a happy family with a great big hug and a kiss from me to you. Won't you say you love me too?